I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow.
Hello and welcome to the Abroad in Japan podcast, probably the best way of learning about life in Japan without actually being in Japan. I'm your host Chris Broad and we're joined by top London radio DJ and Brian Cranston's new bestest friend, Pete Donaldson. Pete, how are you doing?
Me and Walter White hanging out doing a bit of, was the drug they took? Not crack, what did they make? I can't remember, but meth. They made some kind of meth.
Staggering amount
it.
Of crystal meth.
Yes, blue meth.
Well done though, well done for getting him to shout out the podcast. I was quite happy with that. Of all the celebrities you chose, all the celebrities you could have got, Bryan Cranston's a solid one, especially as people always seem to compare me to Frankie Muniz, especially a few years ago. I don't know why. I don't see the resemblance.
Which one's Frankie Muniz?
From Malcolm in the Middle, the main guy.
I don't see that at all. No, I don't see that at all.
Good.
Good.
And also Marcus Mumford, apparently. I guess that one makes a bit more sense, but
there's a little bit more of a facial representation there. But I mean, I would hazard that you're a little bit more handsome than Marcus Mumford. Then again, Marcus Mumford is incredibly charismatic, and I always enjoy interviewing him. Well, so there we go.
Of course, yeah, you would have met him, actually got to see firsthand. Yeah, good job of Bryan Cranston. I actually always think of Japan when I think of him these days, given that he was in the recent Godzilla movie.
Years ago. He was, wasn't he? Yeah.
And more recently, Isle of Dogs, which I'm dying to see. Wes Anderson. I'm guessing you had to see it to interview him, right?
Yeah, every time you interview someone, you have to watch their films. And Isle of Dogs is such a good film, Chris. I know you want to see it, and I know it's not out for a little while in Japan, but what a film!
I mean, I watched Fantastic Mr. Fox the other day to get in the spirit.
Oh, did you? Did you get in the mood?
I did, but now I've got to wait another 2 months before it bloody well comes out here.
Maybe someone will leak a screener or something. But it is mainly, I mean, there's a lot of Japanese in there. And stylistically, just seeing the way that they sort of write the Japanese and write the English translations and stuff. And there are huge kind of swathes of it just in Japanese. And you just got to work out what they're saying from the way that they gesticulate and things like that. It's really interesting.
Did your speedy Japanese lessons from this podcast come in handy?
Nobody at any point said Hiroi. So unfortunately not, no.
Oh, too bad. Yeah, no, I'd love to see it. I really would. I saw some, like, critics like, had a pop at it for the old whitewashing business, you know. But it doesn't seem like the sort of film that would actually be an issue there. What do you make of that?
I mean, none of the breeds specifically are Japanese dogs. And, I mean, I presume Mayor Kobayashi is Japanese because he speaks Japanese most of the way through the film. So I think everyone who speaks Japanese is Japanese. The dogs themselves. The problem is, you know, Japan isn't a big market. China's obviously a huge market and stuff. So I understand why people get upset about that sort of thing. But at the end of the day, you've got to sell a film globally. And if you're going to have characters that are dogs that aren't Japanese, you're going to have to pull in some Hollywood people to sell your film. That's just the way it goes, unfortunately.
Absolutely. Yeah, but I mean, I've got to wait 2 months for the Isle of Dogs to come out now, so Bugger. God damn it. Damn you, Japanese film culture. I don't know why that is. It's coming out in like every country in Asia. I looked it up. I even thought about like flying to Taiwan or South Korea just to see it earlier.
For
some reason, always the latest one in Japan. Yeah. I don't know why that is.
Do you want to have a crack at flying to Taiwan again? Is that somewhere you're going to be doing? Chris has had a terrible week this week. He tried to fly to... It was Taiwan, wasn't it?
It was Taiwan, yeah.
Yeah. What happened, Chris? Come on.
I was going to Taiwan to see a friend for like 3 or 4 days. It was a much-needed 3 or 4 days, given that I've had a pretty hardcore month in March. I'm trying to put out more videos this month on the channel than ever before. And, so it was my light at the end of the tunnel, going to Taiwan, seeing some friends, catching up, and just having a bit of time off. I passed through airport security. I got to the boarding gate, whatever, about to get on the plane, and they looked at my... This woman came over and was like, show me your passport. I was like, here's my passport. She looked at it, and she was like, oh, you can't go to Taiwan. You need 6 months on your passport before you go to Taiwan. And my passport expires in May or June or something. So, yeah, I was escorted back through the airport looking like an idiot. I had to go... It was awkward because technically I left Japan, right? Because I'd gone through the departures and the security and immigration. So I had to come back into Japan again through immigration, feeling like an utter mug, being escorted by two staff from the airline. And I just felt like... Just such an idiot.
What are your...
And I was sitting on the train coming back from Sendai Airport, just like, what have I done?
I'm an idiot.
And, yeah.
What are your...
So I can't travel outside Japan for a while.
I like the idea of you being at immigration, sort of being readmitted to Japan, going, what are your reasons for travel? What are your reasons for coming to Japan?
Just being a mug.
You're going,
yeah.
I live here and I'm silly. Oh. I was a silly boy.
Oh no, good.
Chris, that's no good. Well, at least you've managed to squeeze more videos out, and that's the main thing, and that's what people...
Yeah, March was a good month for videos. I've kind of feel good about myself. I think we've got like 7 videos out, a new record. I think the record before was like 4 videos, so yeah. But yeah, I thought that today, this podcast, we'd talk about just life behind the scenes as a YouTuber, and our careers and the way our lives have gone. Because I get loads of people asking me for careers advice, and it's really awkward. I get dozens every month, people asking me around the world, like, what they should do after they've left high school.
Yeah.
It's just really awkward. I mean, I'm just a YouTube guy. I make videos in my bedroom. I'm not an expert on careers. But, you know, I do give some advice. I don't know if I have anything useful. The one thing I say to people is... Try and imagine you're 80 years old. I read this in a book once, like a self-help book. It was like, imagine that you're about to die. What would you want your life to look like? And you've got to imagine your funeral and what it would all look like and how your life would have played out. It's quite a depressing way of looking at things, to be honest. But so I always try and tell people to think about what you want your life to look like when you look back at it. And for me, I kind of want mine to look like a pirate movie mixed with James Bond, somewhere between Pirates of the Caribbean and James Bond.
I mean,
hasn't quite worked out.
You never see James Bond in front of a copy of Adobe Premiere editing videos. But I mean, look, that might
or
be the next film.
Or not getting on the plane because of his passport's run out. Imagine that.
No,
James
Mr. Bond.
Getting at least to fly over to, I don't know, get to China or something. It's like, sorry, Mr. Bond, you can't fly. Your passport runs out in 6 months.
No, Mr. Bond, really I expect you to go to the passport office and stand in a line for ages.
What I would
say about Chris is that Chris is a bit younger than me, and to see a man so young, yet so, well, very a lot younger.
Very.
Let's not get into it on the podcast, Chris. I want people
mid-30s.
To. It's not about me. Mid-30s. It's not about me. It's about you and your achievements. But also, I don't want people getting upset that they have to listen to someone in their mid-30s. You know, it's just one of those things, isn't it? And also, I can give you a perspective. I'm 36. I want to give you a perspective of someone who's a little bit older, you know. A little bit more mature, Chris, yeah? With responsibilities. I don't have any responsibilities. That's
so
why I go
wisdom.
To Japan every year.
It's true.
Anyway, you're in Japan, you should respect your elders. I want to know in front of every noun.
I hate that part of the culture, the whole looking up to elderly people just because they're elderly. I mean, obviously, we do that in the West, but they do it here, to the extreme, to the point that it's a bit silly.
Oh, you've grown a beard. I must respect you.
But, like, yeah, I mean, it's a topic I get asked about a lot. Being a YouTuber is a weird thing. Mm. It's, like, one of the most popular career paths for people here at the moment, for teenagers at school. Think of it, a lot of teenagers were asked about it. What was the top three jobs? And, like, YouTuber was up there. I think it's because Japanese YouTubers generally just sit in their bedroom and just talk about things. And it doesn't look kind of... doesn't require that much effort. Yeah, it's a lot more laid back, whereas I tend to travel a lot and it's a lot more hard work. Although I'm thinking, why do I travel so much, given that the videos that always do the best just involve me sitting in my room talking about things. So I think I'm going down the wrong way of making videos. But yeah, it's very popular. I don't understand why, but yeah, so I thought I'd talk about that today.
But you have made a transition from kind of person who does sit in his bedroom, you know, talking about how you learned the Japanese kanji or stuff like that, because that's where I first experienced you, because I was a bit of a fanboy, Chris, before we met. But that's how I first remember sort of seeing you, like, a couple of years ago when I was first trying to learn Japanese. But you've kind of expanded and become a filmmaker, haven't you, really?
That was, I guess that's kind of the aim. Like, there comes a point where saying to people, I'm a YouTuber, gets a bit old. Like, if you try going to a party or a networking event, and people are like, what do you do? I go, I'm a YouTuber. And they go, oh, yes, the sandwiches are over here. And that sort of slowly walk off and edge away. But no, like, YouTube, for me, it's always been, like, a stepping stone to something more, to, like, being a filmmaker. So I guess, naturally, that was the way things were going to go. Although back when I started in 2012, when I came to Japan, I'd never anticipated that I'd still be doing it now. It was always kind of a little hobby. I'd like to say that I'm a genius who, like, foresaw that this would all happen and, like, could see that things would go down this route. But it was kind of a combination of luck and good timing, I guess. Like, when I came here, there weren't that many vloggers in Japan, to be honest. YouTube was still a bit new. It's 2012. YouTube was still coming into, like, becoming like the platform it is now. And one of the reasons I did it was because I looked up where I was coming, where I was going to live in Japan, and there was nothing online. Absolutely nothing. Like, it was easy to find videos on, like, Tokyo and Osaka, but the countryside, there was nothing. So I kind of thought, there's a hole to be filled there. A hole to be filled full of videos.
Yeah, full of Chris Broad, a Chris Broad shaped hole. Yeah, it is. You're right though. And when someone's got an interest in a particular subject, like, it's very easy to fall down a click hole and watch all of the videos. You know what I mean? Like, I must have piled through, like, you know, like 99% of everyone's videos about Japan and stuff. What is there, like a bit of a community with, because you sort of occasionally see the same faces, like the redhead girl who's in a couple of your videos. Sorry, I'm being very rude, but I don't know
Rachel,
her name. But, like,
Rachel,
and I think she's got married, and now she's got her own channel with her husband, I think. And you see these kind of, like, and you get snapshots of everyone's lives because the faces are kind of always there or thereabouts, so to speak.
I mean, there is a community. We call ourselves J-Vloggers.
J-Vloggers!
it's not the most flattering term. In fact, I hate it. But nonetheless, we are J-Vloggers, vloggers living in Japan. And the community, it used to be a bit more prominent. I think, about three or four years ago, everyone kind of knew each other. There was lots of meetups and things. But in recent years, not so much. I'm not sure why that is.
People are busy.
People left Japan. Yeah, people are busy. People have left, you know.
A lot
of the people from the early days have gone now. Travelled away from Japan and left and gone back home. So, yeah, it's changed. But I'm lucky to know most vloggers in Japan, like Rachel, the redheaded girl you mentioned.
Yeah.
Rachel and Jun. They're probably the biggest J-vlog channel. They're certainly bigger than mine. They got like 1.2 million subscribers. What has happened is I haven't noticed many new channels, like, pop up in the last few years, though. It's like the channels, this is the worrying thing about YouTube, I often wonder if it's kind of already matured. It's a lot harder now to break through if you're a new channel, because you've got these established channels already with millions of subscribers and whatnot, that are already there, kind of taking all the cake. But luckily I seem to be in that part. I seem to have a nice piece of the cake myself. Complain about that.
You got in with the old cake when it was still young cake.
I did, and now
you've got a cupboard full of old cake.
Perhaps a pizza would have been a better analogy, given the number of pizzas I eat every week with the podcast. Although,
can we get a pizza update?
No pizza this week.
What?
No pizza at all. I know.
And you were feeling rather under the weather as well. This could be pizza related. Your pizza levels are so low right now, dangerously low.
Yeah, I felt a bit weird today. Not so energetic. I guess it's lack of pizza. So, pizza withdrawal symptoms.
So obviously, you started as an English teaching assistant in a Japanese school. How quick and how easy was the transition? I mean, obviously, we've spoken at length about the administrative challenges that faces anyone who wants to change careers or change visas in Japan. How quickly was that transition and how easy was the decision to make?
I always said, like, if I had 100,000 subscribers, I would do it full time. And it took, I think it took 2.5 years to get to that point. It was pretty slow because I only made, like, one video a month because I didn't have time to do any more, basically.
Yeah.
And I kind of thought, if I can't make that many videos, then I better just put as much effort into it as I can every month, right, with one decent, fairly well-edited video. Yeah. But yeah, it took 2.5 years to get 100,000. And then I was like, oh, crap, I've got 100,000. Now I've got to actually do this full-time. So I originally was going to stay for 2 years as an English teacher, but I decided to stay in Japan as a vlogger, do YouTube full time. So I did one more year of teaching English, taking my full time as a teacher to 3 years.
Yeah.
And I gave that years a kind of planning time to work out what I was going to do. It was tough though. I mean, I finished teaching and I went back home for about 3 or 4 months, I think, and kind of planned out what I was going to do. And then I ended up moving to Sendai because where I was living before in Sakata and Yamagata, there weren't any, as lovely as it was, and I still go back there, I love it so much, there's just no business opportunities, as you could probably tell. I mean, you've been there, you've seen it. There's not a whole lot going on business wise and it's quite far from civilization in general.
So I
moved to Sendai, and I actually met a venture capitalist a few months before that. I met a venture capitalist. I went to startup weekend? You know, startup weekend?
Okay, so where you all kind of...
like a fake business or something over the course of the weekend.
Mm.
And I met this venture capitalist who introduced me to Ryotaro, who's in lots of the videos. And he thought, Ryotaro does a lot of stuff with trying to... He kind of focused on inbound tourism and stuff, and we kind of saw that this was a good way we could connect, and he encouraged me to move to Sendai because that's where he was. He said we could make videos together, and I thought Sendai is beautifully connected to everything and it's still in Tohoku, so I moved to Sendai. But the first year was pretty tough there because I kind of started from scratch again. I lived in an apartment that cost just a staggering amount of money. It was like 10 man a month, which was like all my income gone on rent. And it was really tough. That make or break year back in 2016 was like my hardest year as a YouTuber. But by the end of the year, things were taking off and things were good. And it's been all right since then. But it's a strange thing being a YouTuber. I often wake up in the morning and think, what the hell am I doing? I'm my own boss. I don't have to do anything. If I sit here in bed, nothing happens.
Yeah.
But if I get out of bed, I can, make a video and that'll get a few hundred thousand views or whatever.
Did you ever get that feeling where you've taken like an hour off to play a video game or just relax, but you feel incredibly guilty because there's always something you could be doing? There's something you could be doing. It's almost getting into a routine and a headspace where you're like, it's cool to take a couple of hours off because my videos will be better for it. But do you ever get the anxiety of sort of like, oh, I'm if I don't do this right now, I'm just never going to get done and stuff?
I was talking to a friend about this the other day, how, like, it's weird. As a YouTuber, I see my life as a video game these days, as an RPG. Does that sound creepy? Does that
a lot of side quests?
Definitely does. But, like, you think every minute that I'm wasting, I could be doing something productive. I could be making a new video, I could be networking, I could be travelling. As much as I love video games, I haven't played them half as much over the last 5 years as I did before. I used to love video games. Only recently, since I got that Switch that we discussed, have I been playing like Skyrim, like maybe every day for like an hour or so. But any more than that, and I do get this kind of, I get this feeling of anxiety kicking in that I'm doing something wrong, that I should be focusing my efforts on doing something in real life. Whenever I'm meeting someone in a quest in Skyrim, I'm thinking that's somebody I could have met in Tokyo on a quest and unlocked the opportunity to make a film or something ridiculous like that. Really stupid way of seeing the world, to be honest. But you have to be like that. To be successful, I guess, to do well, you need that kind of anxiety and pressure within yourself to like give you the kick and get out of bed and get things done.
When you do your videos and stuff, like obviously when I first watched one of your videos, it was when I was trying to learn a couple of words and trying to learn a little bit of vocabulary and stuff. You rarely speak Japanese in your videos. In fact, you never, even when you say the odd word and stuff, it's always very well signposted, very well kind of covered with English translations and stuff. Because your Japanese is excellent, but you seem quite shy in your videos to use it. Why is that?
Yeah, I guess it's become like a thing. Like in the early days, it was because I didn't know Japanese. Then it was because I was a little bit shy, and now it's kind of just stuck. I mean, there is a far more practical reason, and that is, I think, like 95% of my viewers probably don't know any Japanese. And I don't
but it's impressive, Chris. It's very impressive.
My Japanese used to be all right 2 years ago, but it has gone downhill. It's really awkward when people ask, oh, how's your Japanese these days? Because it has gone down. It peaked in, I think, 2015 or 16 when I did this speech contest and I had to memorise a 15-minute Japanese speech word for word. For some reason, that was what they did in the speech contest. Stupid.
Bloody hell.
But, yeah, it was the hardest thing I've ever done. But after that, I kind of just lost all motivation because I was like, well, that's the peak. There's nothing else.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you've beat the final boss and you've gone back and,
beat the
you know,
final boss.
Do a couple of quests.
I can't believe I did it. I still can't believe I was able to do it.
It's incredible.
I used to be terrified of public speaking before that, but after I did that, I was like, no problem. And it kind of prepared me for like the TEDx talk thing last year.
So where did that come about? That was like a TED talk in Tokyo, was it? Sort of talking about being a YouTuber.
This one was in Tohoku, and they kind of asked me in to just talk about my life as a vlogger, and it was a little bit scary. Unfortunately, half the audience didn't understand English, it seems, so it was a bit awkward. Like, I'd crack a joke, and about five people would laugh. Whatever.
Yeah, I mean, that's the reason, isn't it, Chris? Because didn't speak any English. Definitely.
Yeah, I don't know. My Japanese has gone down, and I'd like to kick it back into gear. I'd like to get back to studying. But, again, it's one of those things, isn't it? Like, I always try and focus on the one thing that's most important to me right now. And the thing that's most important to me right now is becoming a filmmaker, especially after the Bryan Cranston intro. I listened to that and I thought, God damn it, wish I was friends with Bryan Cranston. Maybe if I make a movie.
I'm literally not friends with Bryan Cranston. He just came in for some interviews. Interviews that celebrities and showbiz,
That means
actors,
you're best friends with them.
They hate doing press. They hate having to do 3 days in a hotel.
Did he hate you?
And no doubt when they finally meet me, they hate me too. So there we go.
And your happy northern accent. Did you get all right with him?
He was genuinely very, very sweet indeed. It's been a good week for interviews, actually. I've got Emily Blunt next, I think, at some point.
Everyone's been lovely.
Everyone's been lovely. It doesn't always happen like that. Sometimes it's just a bit like, oh, this is a bit rubbish. But it's always like the difference between getting film stars in the studio rather than having to go to a hotel, because they have these hotels where they set up in like a really swanky place, and you just get a procession of people. You get given your little discs, your little memory cards afterwards, and then you just bugger off after like getting about 5 minutes. It's just not worth doing at all. But luckily, because we're in a radio station that has, you know, seven or eight different brands, everybody wants a slice. Everybody wants a piece.
Yeah, exactly.
So
it's not quite as glamorous as you'd expect.
It's dreadful, Chris. Truly dreadful. Truly dreadful. In the same way that people who are Japanophiles and people who want to move to Japan and you know drink and eat and be merry. It's very different to, you know, the 9-to-5 grind of being an English language teacher or just living in Japan and dealing with the post office and the bank.
Yeah, I guess people only see the glamorous sides of stuff like that. Like,
exactly.
I remember when I met you, when I learned about what you did and when I saw your interviews, I was like, that lucky rascal. But the more I talked to you about it, the more I kind of felt, it's probably not
good. Not things that good.
It kind of be a bit of a tease having Bryan Cranston come in, having like 8 minutes before he's whisked away.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't even get to speak to him like in a normal conversation kind of thing.
No, exactly.
Same people like always think being a vlogger's glamorous, right? You know, it looks good. On my videos, I travel to the mountains of Hokkaido. I sleep in temples. I go to wonderful places and sit in onsen. But it's actually, like, shooting out and about is not particularly glamorous. It is a bit nightmarish.
And
especially for me, because I am the cameraman, I'm the presenter, I'm the director. I have to think about how what I'm filming is going to make sense. It's going to make, like, how it's going to work as a video, how the narrative is going to be there. So, and I edit it as well, which takes like hours on end, hunched over a laptop. So it's not quite as glamorous as you make out. It's nice. The best moment is when you have the finished video, right? And you kind of go, oh, it's done. 15 minutes. You upload it and then bang, a few thousand people watch it. That's the moment. It's all worth it. But before that, it's not as fun a process as you'd imagine.
And especially when you are having to film everything yourself, and also like, you're in a culture where it's not particularly permissive. Everyone's kind of very polite and stuff, but like you've got to have your wits about you. What's okay to film, what's not okay to film, which people will allow you to film in their restaurant, or which people will allow you to film, and liaising with that, I imagine, is half the struggle. The administrative side of, you know, can I film in here, can I film my friends eating a big gyoza,
yeah,
can I
take the fun out of it.
Yeah.
Well, we filmed in a ramen shop a few weeks ago for a video we did about ramen. And the ramen shop owner was like, nope, you can't film us making it. I was like, what? Why didn't we? I think he might have said before that we could, but we didn't. I obviously, when it came to it, it didn't happen. And I was like, God damn it. That was like the most important thing in this video about ramen. And you won't let us film you making it. So
was he scared?
Yeah, it can be a bit annoying.
He was just incredibly he had really dirty hands or something. He was just really just worried that you were the health board.
Yeah, like, I mean, his excuse was, it's a secret, the making of the ramen's a secret. Bollocks. Everybody knows how you make ramen.
Bit of chicken.
I even saw him making it. It was very like normal, but fair play to him. You know, you can't push people.
No,
like, let me film it. No, let me film it. On YouTube, it doesn't work, does it? You find actually the one tip to get around it, though, is to just talk to people in advance before you film.
Yeah,
like a week in advance. Whenever I film in a restaurant, like we did the Monster Gyoza thing recently, we had to ring them up like 4 days in advance, and so try and just ring ahead in advance, and it's fine, no problems. And that's the only way around. That's the best way around it, to be honest. And once you ring up and ask for permission, 9 times out of 10, people do say yes. So
Yeah.
I mean, that's not the difficult thing about filming in Japan, really. I'd say filming in Japan is actually a doddle. People don't get in the way. People aren't annoying. Like, if you film in the UK, people might shout or make noises as they walk past or whatever. But, like, it doesn't happen here.
Right.
It's actually been quite a nice process being here and making videos. But, I mean, I'm a vlogger. That's not so glamorous. You're a radio DJ, top London radio DJ. And you've had quite a good little career. I say a little career. It's a big career. It's quite good.
Now you must die.
How did
die.
You even get to being like a radio DJ? How does that even happen? For people listening who are considering being radio DJs so they can meet Bryan Cranston, what advice would you give?
Well,
tell us your story.
In many ways, YouTube is flourishing and radio is very much in a very different place. But how I became a radio no DJ, as they say in Japan, was I was working for local government in London, a housing quango, basically helping people move out of social housing in London.
Really?
helping them move up north, basically. I was a marketing guy.
What you do now? Bloody hell.
Yeah, hugely. And I wasn't very good at, like, the design side of things. I was doing a bit of design, bit of marketing, bit of liaising with local councils up north and stuff. But I was, and then I just started listening to a couple of radio stations in London. One was XFM. Now, I really enjoyed The Breakfast Show, and I really enjoyed the people who used to be.
Ricky Gervais and
I mean XFM's like the alumni that used to DJ on there is like Adam and Joe and Stephen Merchant and Ricky Gervais and Carl Pilkington and Simon
Pegg.
It's
got a bit of a cult status. It's kind of like the legendary radio station.
Yeah, so it sort of got everyone together when they were a little bit younger in their careers and managed to get some really.
You
really
actually
good
worked with Carl Pilkington for a bit, didn't you?
Very, very brief. Yeah, a couple of months crossover on that
is he,
one.
What's he like in real life? Like, everyone wants to know, like, if Carl Pilkington is what he's like on like in video. He's like in real life? Is there?
I'd say he is very much like he is in real life. But he's very much in real life like he is on the television.
So
and stuff like that. So confusing.
Trying to explain Carl Pilkington.
When it's identical. But he. Yeah. But I think on television. I think on radio. I think he knows in the same way that you know on most of my podcasts I play, you know, an idiot character sort of thing. He knows how to weaponize his idiocy for cash
that's
dollars.
That's a really cool phrase. I'm going to have to write that down.
Weaponized idiocy.
Weaponized idiocy. The future. It doesn't surprise me, to be honest.
No.
Like, you get the sense that he clearly knows what he's doing.
Oh, yeah, he's not an idiot. Yeah.
And he's quite a good actor as well. If you see him in Derek.
I thought he was quite good at Derek, yeah. Really, really good.
But you've also worked on the Tokyo Game Show as well, haven't you? That's like one of your ways into Japan. You'd come here and like present pieces on the Tokyo Game Show, right?
Yeah, kind of.
Tokyo Game Show. Yeah,
the Tokyo TGS in where is it? It's near Narita,
Shinjuku.
Isn't it?
I've never been.
It's out
never
in there's a place between the airport and the main station.
Chiba?
It's kind of. Chiba, it's in Chiba. There we go. Chiba, and it's a bit of a schlep on a hangover. That's all I'm saying. So the first time I actually came out, I didn't actually manage to get to TGS. I did manage this time round though, and I was officially there on a Tokyo Game Show kind of press pass. When it comes to Japanese gaming and US / Western gaming, it's just night and day. Like there are titles there I've never really heard of in my life, and to be honest, most developers now are going out to they're not even making video games anymore. Look at Metal Gear Solid. Look at Konami. Concentrating
it's a shame,
on there.
Konami have gone to turning into just making out these silly phone app games.
Or Pachinko.
Yeah, it's a pretty sad trajectory.
Pachinko. We'll have to talk about that in future episodes.
Well,
Pachinko
is a whole different ballgame.
But yeah, it's
for another day.
It's a lot of fun, but it's very confusing, very loud. Mm. Mainly like walking around Shibuya, really confusing and loud.
But did you actually want to be a radio DJ? At what point did you like come into it? How did it happen?
No, I never wanted to be a radio DJ in itself. I wanted to be like a sidekick because it's just a lot easier. You get to do more gags, and to be honest, a radio DJ is such a weird discipline because you're literally playing out songs. You're literally sort of saying, "Hello, I'm Pete. Here's a song I didn't write. I'll be back in a second for no good reason."
At what point did you go like, "I want to be a radio DJ one day"? Were you like at school, for example, 18 or whatever?
Oh God, no!
Did you
think that was something
you wanted to do, or did you make
radio
stations at home on your computer, as I used to do with friends?
No aspirations at all, really. As I said, I was just... Yeah. I used to just listen to XFM when I was on my way to work and when I was on my way home from work, and it was just literally me going on a little digital radio that had terrible reception. Just me sort of going, like you in many ways, sort of saying, you know, what do you want your life to be like? And I remember it being very difficult. I was on like £30,000 for working for the government because it was a good job, and I'd gone through a few different pay grades, and that went down to when I moved to XFM. Started on work experience. So I was doing that in the morning and then going to work at about 10 o'clock, doing a breakfast show, going to work for a full day of work, and then managed to get myself a little job. I was co-presenting / assistant producing on Lauren Laverne's show, and I got to produce people like Adam and Joe, Danny Wallace, things like that. And going on, and I went down to like, I think it was about 10,500, which in London is just unworkable, massively unworkable.
Wait, 10,500?
Yeah, it just unworkable. Oh yeah, there was no money in radio, and there's certainly no money now.
I know like people a lot of people do like work experience for free and stuff, internships.
Yeah,
to get their foot in the door, but that's pretty brutal, bloody hell.
That was a good couple of years before I sort of said to the person I was working with, Alex Zane, I said, look, I can't do this anyway. Yeah. You need to talk to your agent. Who needs to talk to? And he managed to double my salary. I mean, that was still only 20 odd grand. I made my money up by doing DJ sets and stuff at the weekend and little production jobs and stuff. But it was just, I mean, looking back, it was.
So you did have that kind of make or break period, right? Where things, you could have just given up and gone back to work and go on. You had to go through kind of tough few years to actually get onto XFM and stay there.
Yeah, I mean, it is just about diversifying and trying to just help out where you can. You can't always just do stuff through goodwill, because you're going to be fucked. But excuse my language, but you know, give yourself a couple of years, see if you can eke out a living doing it.
Yeah, I do see parallels there. Like I know I touched upon earlier how I came back here and, you know, as a sort of test run when I moved to Sendai, but
yeah.
Like, I was using credit cards, I wasn't making any money, because I hadn't made any videos in a long time, the YouTube channel wasn't generating any money. So I had to use loads of credit cards, which I was able to pay them off after a few months, but yeah, I had that kind of period where I kind of put myself in what seemed like an unnecessarily difficult situation. I could have done loads of jobs, so I turned down like a job as a consultant to do it, and the consultancy job would have paid lots more, but at the end of the day, I wanted to be a YouTuber. I wanted to try it out and see what would happen going down that road, you know, otherwise you'd just kick yourself. So, yeah. I do see parallels there, what you did.
Yeah, it's a singular focus, isn't it? And sort of going, well, what
but then again, everybody wants to romanticise their story, don't they?
Yeah, hugely, hugely.
For the autobiography, the difficult years. Like, really, yeah, I did have a bit of a tough time, which, yeah, I did have a tough time, but in the grand scheme of things, compared to most people, I guess it was no big deal. But you do have that crunch time for a lot of people. If you're listening and you've got a dream and you hit that crunch time point, just keep on going, and hopefully things will turn out all right.
Get crunchy.
Get crunching. With that, it's time for Speedy Japanese.
Yay, Speedy Japanese, my favourite part of the show, where I underwhelm with my memory.
I thought I'd keep it simple this week with one expression. Because I guess, to an extent, I started out YouTube as a hobby, and you... Well, actually, I don't know if you started out what you're doing as a hobby. It was actually the real thing, wasn't it?
Well, was it? Yeah,
I teach you as a hobby.
Oh, hobby! This is like, right, okay.
The key... This is like one of the first things you learn in Japanese. Do you know the word for hobby?
I do not know the word for hobby, Chris.
Do you not? It's like, no. Whenever you like learn Japanese in any book or anything, it's like the first... Probably like the 10th phrase in that you learn.
Oh, really?
The 10th word in.
I've not encountered it.
Everybody loves this word. And when I was teaching English, all the students have to, like, all the students are fluent at it. I don't know why. But yeah, the word for hobby is shumi.
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 Shumi, shumi, shumi.
And me, shumi.
Yeah.
And to say your hobby, you know basic grammatical Japanese structure, don't you?
Very basic,
don't you? So, like, you'd say shumiwa. So shumiwa, wa means regarding. So regarding my hobby, shumiwa, and then whatever the hobby is. In your case, it's soccer, right?
Yeah, I like a bit of soccer.
You love your soccer.
Yeah,
you love it. So you'd say shumiwa soccer, soccer desu. Simple.
Shumi wa soccer.
Regarding my hobby, it's football, it's soccer. And for me, I guess I'd say shumi wa YouTuber des. YouTuber des. I don't think I'm ever going to use that in any situation or conversation ever. But there you go. Shumi. You hear it a lot. People love it here. Hobby.
Because you're obviously shumi wa YouTuber des, which is your hobby. It's also YouTuber. Your job, though. It's also your job, though, isn't it? So would that be shigoto? Shigoto wa YouTuber des?
You're using words from previous podcasts.
Yes, thank
good.
You.
Yeah, good.
Thank you.
Same thing, yeah. Shigoto wa. Shigoto wa YouTuber des.
Shigoto wa YouTuber
des. So regarding my job, it's YouTube. Yeah, I think Japanese, in many ways, the grammatical structure's not too difficult once you've got your head around that. that wa basically means regarding. So whatever you say, if you follow it up with wa, it means regarding. So if I say, like, pizza and wa, regarding Pete, saka ga suki desu, he likes football.
Yeah, I do.
But yeah, shumi. And now, let's dive into Wacky News of the Week.
Wacky News of the Week, my other favourite bit of the podcast.
So I woke up this morning, went down the news feed on Facebook, and this video was bloody everywhere.
Right.
And it is, I mean, it looks cool. I mean, it is cool. It's samurai with jetpacks having a mid-air battle with katana swords. it's like something out of a Michael Bay movie.
Yeah.
At first, I thought it looked real. But then if you look closer, it doesn't seem real at all. But it kind of works well enough to the point that it's all right. And nobody seems to mind. I don't know what the thought process was behind this.
So there's these two samurai having a scrap with swords. They're on the floor and they're having a fight. And then suddenly they start floating like something out of an Eastern film, a Japanese samurai film. And it's very impressive, isn't it?
It is. I think it's on wires. What do you reckon?
It is massively really on wires, but also
it
the
is,
jet.
Given
the
that,
jet,
like, I know it's at one point one of the guys. Yeah, they're tiny, aren't they?
The jetpack.
One of the guys
joke.
Turns at one point, but like the jetpack moves with him, but it doesn't change direction. I think it's the giveaway. But if you look at it, if you just glance at the video, it is convincing.
Oh, it looks good. It looks fantastic. And also, I think I'm more impressed with the fact that an amateur production managed to get two cranes involved. I was like, I wouldn't even know where to get a crane. So that's more impressive than actually owning a jetpack.
Well, I think the fact that it's just on a handheld kind of camera phone style as well. The video quality is not even that good. It looks like that, doesn't it? You'd think, how the hell could they get a crane in there for that?
Yeah.
I don't know what the context was. I read that it's some sort of Japanese actor and director called Shota Mori, who was famous a few years ago. He made a video where he got he reenacted the scene from Taxi Driver where Robert De Niro flicks his wrist and a gun pops out of his arm. And he kind of created that himself. He actually made that by hand and did it. That video went viral. And this was supposed to be his follow-up video, a samurai battle with jetpacks.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Thoroughly wash your manly body.
Wow.
Got a bit of time for some last-minute questions.
Yeah, let's shove them in. Thank you so much for everyone who's got in touch recently. What's the email address again, Chris? Even though, with my radio training, as discussed last week, you've got to end the piece with the email address.
You lambasted me last week for mentioning it. too early. Let's bookend it. It is abroadinjapanpodcast@gmail.com.
Okay, right. Cool.
Send in any questions you might have there, guys, or any feedback or comments, and they might appear in the show. Like
definitely.
These questions.
Matthew says, hello, Chris and Pete. Thank you, Matthew. I was wondering about the research that goes into your videos. When you compare them to a few years ago, they are getting way more educational with loads of historical footnotes, which I'm quite happy with.
He's probably referring to that video recently where we went to this, like, it was for the ramen video that I mentioned earlier. We went to this temple, which was really cool. It was designed by, influenced by Leonardo da Vinci. So random, this like little temple in Fukushima. And we went around the back of it, and there's a statue donated by Benito Mussolini in like the 1930s or something. And it's so weird that it's there, like in the middle of nowhere in Fukushima. But I didn't research that. I genuinely didn't know that that was there, just climbing around the back of a mountain.
Just hanging out.
Yeah, there was this statue donated from Pompeii, one of like three in Pompeii. Benito Mussolini sent it to Japan as he was inspired by some local samurai warriors from that town in Fukushima in Aizu Wakamatsu. So, yeah, I learned that on the go. I learned it there and then, and that's why I kind of seem so surprised in the video. But,
I do try
to do some research, obviously. It's highly recommended, especially if you're spending enormous amounts of money travelling around to various places in Japan. You need to do research. So, yeah, there's a fair bit of research, I guess.
And that's the thing, like, every town's got a little story, every town's got a little quirk, every town's got a different kind of ramen that's slightly al dente than the next.
Or so they'd like to think. Everywhere in Japan thinks it's, like, special and unique.
Yeah. Rebecca's sent an email. Hey, I've been watching your channel for a while now, and I'm a big fan. I'm going to be going to Japan this October/November with a friend, and here's my question. I am a moderately tattooed and all-round modified person. Multiple large tattoos on my arm, leg and back, multiple facial piercings and, of course, dyed hair. I've heard that tattoos are still relatively taboo in Japan compared to the West, and I know certain places frown upon them or ban them outright. I've already accepted there'll be no water park visits for me. I'll have to cover up with temples and the like, and finding an onsen that will let me in will prove tricky. Do you have any further advice or recommendations for a tattooed person visiting Japan? Other things to look out for, / places that may or may not look kindly upon them. My travel partner is already really wanted to stay at a ryokan in Fuji. Are there tattoo-friendly ones, or will that have to be an experience she enjoys on her own? Thank you for your time, and keep up the good work. A smiley face, Rebecca.
Well, I think you feel qualified to answer that one, given that I took you to an onsen, and as the clothes came off, it slowly revealed a tattoo of your own from Monkey
and it was Chris's face.
It was Frankie Muniz's face. I was worried you were not going to get let in. I think there was a sign saying no tattoos, but you didn't give a shit. You just went in.
I don't give a toss.
Dived into the water and was gone. Nobody could see. Well, nobody was any the wiser.
Yeah, well, I've got like two, I wouldn't say heavily tattooed legs, but I mean, most of my calf and front on both legs are pretty, you know, we're not talking a little butterfly on the base of the spine. We are talking, you know, a fair whack of my legs are tattooed. So, yeah, because some places, don't they have little stickers you can put on them? It's all very silly and all a bit of a dance,
they have giant plasters these days you can conceal your tattoos and your modified body with.
Yeah.
But I think it's becoming, luckily, because of the Olympics, more and more, I think the Japanese government was like, please stop this rule to a lot of onsens, because Japanese Yakuza are few and far between these days, especially out in rural areas.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's an issue. So it's changing. It's changing. If there's not plasters, then, I don't know, just try. Just try going in. Even then, I'll be amazed if someone calls you out for it.
No, exactly.
It's a silly rule. Obviously, Pete is not the Yakuza if he's got a tattoo from Monkey Island. I mean, that would be...
That
would be the ideal tattoo to have if you were Yakuza, though.
I've had a tattoo done in Japan, for crying out loud. I got like a mate who I met the first time I actually went to Japan, a guy called Yomi, And he's an incredibly talented chap. And he was without studio at the time. And I went around his house in close to Shibuya, whatever, one of the stations near Shibuya. And he just tattooed me in his house for 4 hours. So there we go. So I've actually had a tattoo done in Japan in some dude's house.
That is cool. I've thought about doing it, but yeah, I have actually, because of I'm often in onsens and things. I've hesitated to do it as a result.
Oh, they're so lovely.
Which is kind of annoying. But I'd say, yeah, just wear a plaster. Ask the staff when you go into an onsen. Often you can find out online. There's even a map I found once where you can type in the onsen and see if it's friendly or not towards tattoos.
Right.
So I would check that out. Just type in onsen tattoos Japan and hopefully the website will come up. But yeah, I don't know. Just try and get in and not worry about it. Or ask the staff or take some plasters.
Yeah, exactly. I mean kind of cover up on the way in, and you know, and once you're past the once you're in the changing rooms, I think, can anyone really stop you, for crying out loud?
No, they can't.
Get involved, mate. International incident. Who cares? We've got
one last question here.
Without
anybody, I don't know who sent it in. Sorry.
Yeah,
I wanted to know why English language is so popular when it comes to marketing for Japanese consumers. Why not other languages? I assume most Japanese people have very little interest in learning English. You say that they do actually. They have very little interest, but English is kind of seen as a cool marketing language. English and French. There's a lot of French around.
Mm.
And what you find is the English isn't always that good, but it's just there. It's interesting. I find businesses just use English, even though it's not grammatically correct. It's often quite weird, just because it makes their business look cool.
Mm.
And it makes people want to go there. It's kind of an easy way of looking stylish.
But we sort of, like, make out, like, we're not exactly the blummin' same. The amount of, like, stupid Japanese nonsense,
that's
like,
true.
Writing.
Super dry. Super dry springs to mind.
Super dry, yeah, I mean, that's ridiculous. I was eating some bloody noodles, Kabuto noodles, before. If you read the back of a packet of Kabuto noodles, it's madness. It's absolute racist, jingoistic madness. Oh, so, we all... I'm looking at the back of a Kabuto noodles packet I've Googled.
Right.
Kabuto noodles are a delicious combination of authentic Asian flavours, quality ingredients prepared with the skill, dedication and discipline of a samurai warrior. Step 2 of the process of creating these bloody noodles. Stir well, leave for 1 minute, then enjoy noodles straight from the pot or pod into a bowl. If you haven't got a bowl available, try an upside down helmet. If you wait 3 or 4 minutes for it to cool down, you have an opportunity to meditate or practice your karate. Failure to follow instructions correctly will bring great shame to yourself and your family. It's just jingoistic.
That's
nonsense.
That
it's
is
dreadful,
so,
isn't it?
So terrible.
Don't eat Kabuto noodles. They don't taste
week.
Nice.
I was in a bookshop and I saw a book with a panda on it. I think it was just a book about pandas.
Nice.
And the two words on the front were panda mental. That was the title of the book. Panda mental.
I mean, they've missed a trick there, haven't they?
Picture
Pandemonium
this disgruntled would work. Looking panda on the front. It didn't even look that mental. But
no.
I don't know what the relevance of that was. I flicked through it, had a look, don't know why it was there. Just a book about pandas. Panda mental.
Yeah, the panda sat in the front going, I'm all right. We've all got our problems. We've all got our issues. Outrageous. I guess we've come to the end of the show. Thank you to everyone who got involved and emailed in. What's that email address again, Chris? Let's bookend this feature.
God. AbroadJapanPodcast@gmail.com.
Woo!
Thoroughly original email address.
Lovely.
You never
job.
Thought it up yourself.
But
thanks for listening, guys. No matter where you might be out there in the big wide world, we'll see you next week.
Yay! Have a good week, guys.
Panda mental.
Make sure your passport's in date, guys, alright? That's all I'm saying.
Ooh.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.